Okay. Sean or Andy, whoever.
I'd like to pull up a little bit and not be so specific about transportation tools and talk about the other side of this. You began the discussion tonight talking about entitlements and projected growth in both Summit County and Wasatch County, and that's scary. That keeps me up at night when I try to project that kind of growth out and the cars and congestions they're going to bring, because we moved here because it's for the quality of life, and those are going to continue to erode at that quality of life. But we have to go back a little bit and look at the mistakes we've made in our land use planning. We're in this predicament because we have expanded in a way and built neighborhoods that don't really work on a transportation system we have today. And we don't really know a transportation system that'll work to access, say, Park Meadows or Jeremy Ranch, unless we come up with some futuristic personal pod system that gets everybody to a central point. We're still going to need to get in cars or get on our bikes and ride to a central place. So when I look at all this development going out, we do have an opportunity to correct our ways. In Park City, in the redevelopment projects we're looking at, because we're mostly built out, we're trying to figure out how do we compact those so they work well with transit. And I think both Summit County has taken a good look at that, and I urge Wasatch County, as they can look to our mistakes and say, these are all the things those guys screwed up. We don't want to make the same mistakes. 20 years from now, we want to build neighborhoods that fit in with the transportation system. Then we're not trying to play catch-up afterwards.
Okay, Sean?
I was thinking about the travel demand management opportunities that you asked for. What exists today? And the first thing that came into my mind is the Utah Department of Transportation's TravelWise program. Your listeners can do a Google search right now for that term, TravelWise. What that'll bring up is two different resource kits, a business resource kit and a community resource kit. UDOT has travel specialists that will go into any community or any business with a training manual and show those businesses or those individuals what they can do today, as Kent mentions, to reduce trips, combine trips, trip chain, combine, or the employer offer, flexible work hours, changing behaviors to get people off that peak PM, peak AM time period. So there is a lot that individuals can do even today and tomorrow to change and reduce the number of trips. It's available for download tonight straight from UDOT's website.
Okay. Allison, did you want to? And our closing thought from Allison, who's very good at summing these things up.
I mean, I think just the most amazing part that I think is hard to wrap our heads around is when I was looking at how to incentivize employees to take the bus, the most common incentive that I found was that they discount the cost to ride the bus, and yet we have a free bus system. So I think we've been forward thinking from the get-go of take away that barrier and allow anyone and everyone to be able to use it. And so the key is now is how do we kind of turn that so that that we do see more people and we can reduce the traffic.
Okay, thank you. Let's turn the remaining time over to the audience. What have you heard this evening that appealed to you? What solutions do you feel are appropriate? What have we not discussed? Gondolas, anyone? Uber, self-driving taxis, technological changes and solutions. Boy, that's a setup for our friend Paul Zane Pilser.
Hello, Bob. Nice to see you here.
Who's got has a question?
I'm an economist and actually heavily into a book on the sharing economy and researching Uber drivers around the world, who I interview pretty regularly. Uber has changed the life of my wife and I when we go to Los Angeles, and that's just one city. 12, 15 appointments a day, I can shoot between things for $2, $3. But the most amazing thing is these Uber drivers aren't Uber drivers. One drove me by a house and said, that's where I live. And then before I could ask, he said, you're probably asking why a guy with a $3 million house is driving for Uber. He says, well, I got divorced. This is my weekend without the kids, and I love driving nice people around, but I don't like the freeway, so I only take rides around West LA. Carrying that forward, it's already established fact that one Uber car replaces five automobiles in the cities they've gone. But more than just Uber, it's already changing Park City. I've been here through 28 Sundances. This was the best Sundance I ever had because of Uber. Because I found out that Uber would get there on an average of 1.5 to 2 minutes to my house, 2 miles from Old Town, but my wife takes 2 minutes to get from our bedroom to the driveway. So they would always get there faster. That's the only thing wrong with Uber. I have to call them a little later and trust they'll be there. But more significantly, the Uber experience changed our lives during Sundance, and I said, gee, I'm already getting old. I can get old in this town, because I'll be able to have Uber take me around and drive me, and my guests. And my guests all loved Uber. We weren't chauffeuring them. And they all just programmed their car. And the most significant item is, where are all the Uber drivers? They're in this room, because the new Uber apps say that I'm an Uber driver. I'm not sure I want to take someone. I have work to do, maybe a phone call I'm taking on the car, but if I'm free and I'm driving to the junction where my office is, I say, who's looking for a ride? Ding, click, grab it. And all of a sudden, I am friendly driving my neighbor. And if I don't make $4 on my neighbor, you should have a nonprofit list, and I can elect which of the nonprofits get the $4 that you're going to pay me for driving. Throughout Boston, it's changed college kids' life. My friend calls me up and say, what does my kid do for 90 cents on his Visa card? And finds out that the four kids automatically split the $4 fare. Uber is the answer here. We need to embrace it. We need to embrace Uber apps that make us all Uber drivers on the one or few times we want to go somewhere. It'll change the lives of us suppliers, and prosumers is the term of an Uber driver. Thank you for all this time, Bob.
Thank you, Paul. So Uber, self-driving taxis, technological change?
Uber and all its brands. I mean it generically. I'm not pushing
generic.
Any one brand.
Let me chime in on this.
Unless you haven't owned stock in Uber, then you mean it, Uber.
Kent keeps giving us great advice on council. He says there is no one solution for this, and he keeps trying to drill that into our head. And I think Uber is an example of one of the many tools we can use going forward. And I think that will help a certain portion of our population and our visitors get around better. I also think we can look to Uber as a disruptive technology, and what it's teaching us is that the ease and use of electronics and apps and ability for people to track all this stuff real time appeals to a lot of folks. And if we can find ways to incorporate that into any systems we have going forward, it's going to help.
Okay. I couldn't agree more. And I think that we are, like I said before, Summit County is on the verge of implementing the rideamigos.com. I'd urge all the listeners to check out rideamigos.com. It's a way that you can go in and you can put in your beginning address, you can put in your end address, and it will come up with all the carpools that are going there, all the van pools, all the private van pools. It'll tell you how long it's going to take to walk. It'll tell you how many calories you're going to burn, and like I said before, how many pounds of carbon dioxide it will remove from the air. This Uber is one technology that has worked very well in the world. This is another one, and it's another way that we can help solve the problem. Once again, I want to reiterate that there is no one solution, but these are all tools that we can use, and people like mobile apps that are real-time, and this is one way to get there.
Well, and Lisa, you had also mentioned self-driving cars, and Paul had emailed me some stuff on self-driving taxis. And, you know, it seems so futuristic, but they're talking 5-10 years out. And what's interesting, and if you think 10 years ago, where were we with Facebook and texting and things that everybody takes for granted today? They didn't even exist 10 years, or they certainly weren't in the wide population. A lot of us remember when email was the cutting-edge technology. Heck, a lot of us remember when a fax was cutting-edge technology. So it does change. 5-10 years, what could we see with self-driving where 224 and 248 are regulated so you don't have people braking in that kind of stop-and-go that creates traffic backups?
It's amazing what's out there right now. The self-driving vehicles, they have sensors on all sides of them, so you can be 5 feet away from the next car in front of you. So all of a sudden, you've got these 6 car lengths that is now reduced down to 5 feet. They're supposedly safer. They're supposedly better. The Google car that is driving itself now has airbags on the outside of the car to allow, in case a pedestrian hits the car, the pedestrian won't get hurt. This is actually real, and it's happening. I was just in the North Bay area of California a couple months ago, and I saw a Google car, and it's an amazing technology that I never thought I'd see in my lifetime, but it's here, and it's coming. Flying cars, I know that seems really crazy, but the first flying car will be on the market in 2017, and it will only take 600 feet of pavement to take off and to land. So,
careful it doesn't hit a drone.
If that's scary, that scares the crap out of me, but it's out there, and it's real, and it's coming.
Okay. Just please state your name and your question. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Linda. I don't really have a question. I have a comment on a lot of the different things, and I think that I really liked what I think it was Leslie that said about bringing transportation into the neighborhoods. And I previously lived down closer to Old Town, used public transportation all the time. It was very easy for us. But now we've moved out further in, back into this neighborhood, but not on the bus line. And I know, I think that the easiest solution right now is to increase buses, make the buses smaller, and get them into the little neighborhoods and make park and rides. And I've had so many people, I live near Willow Creek, and I've heard so many people say, well, the people over there won't take the buses. And I'm like, what do you mean? If we had, if we could park at the Willow Creek park, there seems to be enough spots there, and buses could come into there, I would certainly have used the bus all winter long when I had 45 house guests throughout the winter. We did not want to take two cars to the resorts every time they wanted to go skiing, yet we had to do that because we didn't really have an alternative other than driving up to Kimball Junction, parking up there kind of illegally, I think, and then taking buses from there. And that, you know, that didn't help the problem. So smaller buses would be better. Faster buses, I liken it to when we go to the grocery stores now. I don't know if this makes sense, but it does to me. I hate those huge carts. I love the little carts. Mm-hmm. Everybody wants the little carts. Everybody can zip around. And these big buses are kind of scary. They take forever. They stop so much. And if you do not live on one of those main corridors, you really can't use them.
Okay, well, that's actually a great point. What about as the fleet transitions over, smaller buses, frequency, convenience, these are all the things put people in the seats. Comments?
That's something that my fellow council member, Roger Armstrong, has been promoting for several months. He's been saying, you know, while we do have a good bus system, now we need to find those efficiencies, and one of those is looking for a different size of bus that can more easily make on-demand stops and that type of thing. So we've been discussing that and, of course, working with Kent, too, on looking at those options for the future, and hopefully not too far into the future.
Kent, why don't you talk about the costs of some of those, a big bus versus a small bus, and what some of the issues are, perhaps why we haven't gone that way. Probably a lot of people don't know that we do have an on-demand bus system throughout the service area.
Yeah, we do. Well, yes, we do for seniors and ADA, and then we also have an on-demand system that, or a scheduled bus, that's a schedule a ride, dial a ride, that serves the Queens Junction area. So it's feasible to have multi, you know, size your equipment to the small, you know, to say a neighborhood. Where the challenge in that lies is that if you, and particularly in Park City, we'll see this. We'll drive through a neighborhood, and there'll be nobody maybe for a week, and then all of a sudden there's 70 people there, and so, you know, that have come to stay and ski. So the point there is that you want to have the, you got to have the capacity or an ability to respond. Otherwise, people are left standing at the curb. Neighborhoods, smaller buses, indeed, make some sense. I think, particularly some of the neighborhoods out here in the basin, some of the roads are quite narrow, hilly, such as Bear Hollow, right. And so I think they make sense. That, you know, usually what it requires is you end up with a big fleet and a small fleet, sort of sized to the time of year. Then you've got to store that, and so, you know, it's a bit of a more challenge. There's more maintenance cost, but if it's improving service, you know, that's just a factor you got to look at and see if it still makes sense. So.
Certainly, we run four-wheel drive smaller buses up to Silver Lake and Empire Pass area.
Yeah, absolutely, and those work. I guess small is a relative term because they're smaller than a 35-foot bus. They're still fairly large. I mean, what I see is we'll probably have a full range of vehicles. We really do right now. We've got six 19-foot, you know, which are about the size of a van that we use for the dial-a-ride and ADA, and sometimes in our neighborhoods we'll run those. So it's just that you'd like your equipment to be, as a fleet manager, to be as big as to meet the highest demand, but that doesn't always meet meet the service that you're trying to provide. So
give us an idea of the cost of the full size bus versus a smaller bus, and how are they funded or paid for?
Okay, so we've been very successful with federal financial assistance, and the Federal Transit Administration will pay 80% of your rolling stock. 20% has to come from local monies. A 35-foot low-floor bus, 35-foot low, boy, that's hard to say, 35-foot bus. the ones that you've seen running, there's a lot of technology in there. It's, you know, we have AVL real-time, so there's a lot of equipment in there. A bus like you see on the street, new now, some of those are getting a little older, but is around $400,000. Sounds like a lot of money. It is a lot of money. But those are built to last a minimum of 12 years. I think we'll probably end up running a lot of them until they're 15. Now, a smaller bus, I mean, it depends, or a small van-type vehicle, you know, depending on what you get, you're probably 45 to 60,000. You could go up if you're four-wheel drive, somewhere like that. But now those vehicles are lucky to get 4 years out of them, and the doors start to fall off them. They're just not industrial grade like a bus is built. A bus,
interesting.
A transit bus, like the big ones we have, I mean, those are industrial grade, and they don't corrode, and, you know, they're built to last. In fact, the federal government requires any bus they buy that they buy with federal money is tested in a place called Altoona, Pennsylvania, and they run it through, you know, they put it on a bump machine, and they simulate, and it's got to meet that 12-year life. So that's really the big difference, I think, between the two. In terms of, I think at the end of the day, when you run your life cycle cost, they're almost the same, because these lighter-duty vehicles cost a lot more to keep on the road. But when you're trying to fit the product to the customer, looking at these type of things is not purely a dollar and cents equation. So.
Okay. Andy, did you have a comment?
I think there's absolutely opportunities for us to be more nimble, and we have to be, and figure out, as I said earlier, we struggle with some of these broader neighborhoods and not have really set them up in a way that they're possible to access well through transit. I think there are some realistic fiscal constraints that come in, too, and I'm going to take a stab at some numbers, and Kent, please fix it for me if I get them wrong, but I seem to think we saw some numbers that sort of in the core areas, it costs about $1.50 to $3 per rider. And when you start getting out into the more suburban sprawled areas, it's up to $10 a rider. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And I mean, you know, on-demand service, and we could, you know, that we currently operate, I'm sure we can find some efficiencies. But, for instance, where we serve ADA passengers, you're more in like $64 or $65 a ride. Now, that requires a lot of attention and time, but it's, you know, it's a factor of trying to run to a particular area, so on a particular trip.
At that point, we're probably better off just to give them credit for Uber.
Okay. Ma'am, you had a question. Please state your name and your question. Thank you.
Yikes. Hi, I'm Mary McIntyre, and I've lived here for many years. Remember when 224 was just two lanes? And I've worked at Deer Valley part-time for a long time, and the focus has been on the locals, and we're forgetting the tourists. Cost does not influence the guests at Deer Valley. It's convenience. And those of us who sat and sat and sat in the traffic jam on the Monday between Christmas and New Year's know that that was a problem. Took 2.5 hours to get from Deer Valley to here. And so I just would like to think that the buses do not go up to Empire on a regular basis. Guests will pay to have taxis come. They will pay to rent their cars and do it. So consider doing that. And also a very simple fix would be at the intersection by Jan's and Colesport, when you come from Park City, there are two lanes to turn to head out to Kimball Junction when you're coming from Deer Valley. There's only one. Would be a very simple fix to have two lanes, turn right, and speed up things. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. For that, Ken,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, we actually are looking at, with UDOT, the reconfiguration, restriping of that intersection. Engineers at UDOT would argue with it that there's anything simple, but I think your point is well taken, and I we are taking a look to see if that's possible. So you might see that soon. I don't know what the outcome of that will be, but thank you for that.
One thing I'll add is just that we realize there's not a one-size-fits-all. We do want to try to get people out of their cars and into mass transportation, but we also want to get them on bikes and on trails walking, and we realize guests, if they can ride share at times, you know, that helps improve things, and hopefully we can find a very convenient way to get them from the airport up here, and they realize, hopefully after one trip, that they don't need a car once they get here.
Yes, sir. Your question.
Hi, I'm Jim Tedford. I live in Sun Peak across the road. Just another suggestion. I, just the other day, experimented with trying to find a place to park down here where I could get on the bus both ways. Get off the bus coming home, get on the bus, and go up to the resort. As a rule, I drive up there every day. And I think maybe an option, what I do currently, is park over here at the Blue Roof. But they probably aren't going to smile on that for very long if there's a whole bunch of them that try to do that. So rather than more buses, smaller buses going around the neighborhoods, give us a place to come from the neighborhood to the main line. And I think you really should start looking at finding places for people to park along the main line, which currently is 224. It could be 24. It's going to be 248 very soon. And I mean, I'm not going to drive down to Willow Creek. That's not going to work for me. Before I drive to Willow Creek, I'll drive up there because I live up in Sun Peak about a half a mile. But if there's a nice parking place here, I mean, I can make it work right now. And I think before all this land is gobbled up, you should be looking at some of these options of parking along the main lines.
Managed parking and somewhat the realization that once you're in your car, you probably don't want to get out of your car for a short leg of a journey. You just figure, oh, well, I just, you know, turn up the radio and bear it out.
Sure. I think there's a concept we talk a lot about in transit. We call it first and last mile. And every transit trip begins and ends with some other trip. We travel from our house to the bus stop. And I mean, traditional wisdom or traditional thinking is better term, was that if we allow people to get in their car to drive, you know, they're going to continue their trip in the car. One way to maybe perhaps mitigate that is the way you manage the parking, because if there's not parking where you're headed and that bus is the access, but there's parking to access the bus system, that may be one way to accomplish this. So.
Okay. Thank you for that. Other comments on that? Okay. Yes, ma'am. Name and question. Thank you.
My name's Carol Labrizzi, and I just wanted to bring up one important thing that hasn't been brought up yet is sidewalks. So as you work with the developers, I would hope that we would see sidewalks, because I think it's really important, especially if there is a school nearby. I raised my kids here in Silver Springs. They did walk to and from school and rode their bikes, but I know a lot of parents that were concerned about kids being on the street instead of on a sidewalk.
Okay, let's talk about walkability and our trail system and alternative ways of, you know, getting people out of their car.
One thing we talked about last night at our meeting was really fun, and it was a solar-lit walkway, a trail. So we want to try to make it not only accessible but also interesting. Give people a reason to go there because they enjoy it. There's something exciting, fun, different on that pathway to get from point A to point B.
One thing that we've talked about internally as Summit County staff is that there's a difference between walking somewhere and having a pleasant experience walking there. So we are very sensitive to the fact that pedestrian pathways have to be pleasant, and they have to be, just like Kim said, exciting or provide a reason to walk there. Kim and I were just talking before this event tonight about Kimball Junction and how it's a shame that a pedestrian pathway that's pleasant with maybe benches and some trees and some landscaping wasn't provided to allow for access from Redstone to other areas of the villages at Kimball Junction. It is possible to walk there, but it's not very pleasant. I know my 7-year-old and I, when we go to Redstone and we want to go to Smith's, we drive, which is a shame, and I'm embarrassed to say that, but in all disclosure, it's because I'm afraid for my daughter. So, you know, my experience is not unique, and I think that we as Summit County staff, and I believe Park City has the same idea that we want to keep our children safe and we want to keep everyone safe as we move through this process of getting people out of their cars and onto safe bikes, safe trails and sidewalks.
You know, I think if managing special events in Park City, in particular the Olympics, I was about 3 days into the Olympics managing the outload at Deer Valley, and we were trying to load buses, and you could not get enough buses. And we realized, why don't we just get people to walk? It's like 5 minutes to downtown. And so I got a megaphone and started saying, hey, you can wait 20 minutes for a bus or walk in 5 minutes. And So we started to push that during Sundance. We noticed we're really seeing a lot of people walking. And so it depends on the trip. I mean, you obviously aren't going to walk a lot of trips from Kimball Junction to Old Town, but many of our trips are pretty short in nature, and walking is a definite option. The city, I can't remember how many years ago the citizens approved a $15 million walkability bond. I think we're still investing that money, and it will probably run out before we fix everything, as nice as it be, but you know, clearly whatever we can do to help walking, I think, is going to help our mobility and generally our health and our environment. So,
Allison, in Prospector Square, haven't they been talking about walkability as well, trying to make it a little bit more walkable area? And surprisingly, there's some beautiful walking areas there. It's just people don't see them. And then we should all point out that both the city and the county have installed on some of our trails artwork and fun things to do and play or exercise with. And that whole thing about making the walk stimulating as opposed to just getting from point A to point B. But talk about
Absolutely.
Prospector.
So Prospector Square, we're going through a infrastructure improvement study right now, and what we're looking to do is how can we make the area more pedestrian friendly. We're next door to kind of two good neighborhoods, whether that be Park Meadows or Prospector, and how can we encourage people not only to be walking from those neighborhoods to experience Prospector Square, but encourage people within Prospector Square to walk, whether it's the employees during the day or whether someone's staying at the Marriott, the Carriage House, or somewhere else. So we're looking at how can we make our sidewalks wider along the street. Currently, they're very narrow. You can't really pass someone unless someone kind of hops off onto the grass. And then as well, trying to daylight that interior walkway that's behind Good Karma and behind Fuego. So part of that is how do we daylight that? And then as well, how do we add interest? How can you, when you start walking in there, you want to walk a few more feet and see what's next? And how can you kind of add those breadcrumbs so that they will experience that, they will enjoy the walk, and then they'll choose to do it again? So we're about 20% from finishing that project and hoping to start some improvements within 2016.
Yeah, and I remember when sidewalks went from 4 or 5 feet to 8 feet, which seems so ridiculously wide. Why would you need a sidewalk that wide? And now that's a width that people feel comfortable with, and anything less than that seems, you know, very inadequate. So it's another reflection of how things change.
And I think just safety at intersections, making sure that the pedestrian can look around the parked cars and make sure that they know that they have a clear view to cross. So looking at improving intersections, whether those are at street intersections or natural intersections, like where the red bus line stops at the Marriott, and then you have a walkway that a lot of people use for Aspen Villas. It's not an official, but how can we make that official and really highlight those areas?
Okay. Andy, did you have that?
Well, I think you've seen a big push countywide, both in the county and the city, towards walkability, bikeability, trails. I mean, at the end of the day, we're kind of a human-powered culture up here, so it not only gets us where we want to go, but we have fun doing it. And I think you'll see a continued push along that front. This year, we're getting an important piece of our walkability plan in place in the city, 224, what we call the Dan's to Jan's corridor. But there's a section there where the street constricts. There's a ton of traffic. And we're going to be putting a tunnel under Kearns and 224 there. And there's going to be a path that runs along those Park Avenue condos all the way down to Jan's Coles area. But we continue to chip away at that. And I think it's a high priority for this community. And I think it's one of those critical pieces of this web of solutions we're working on.
Okay.
Some exciting things that are happening in the county along those lines are we are hoping to implement a wayfinding program in Kimball Junction that will allow people to be able to park once and find their way to where they need to find. Where they need to go, excuse me. And another thing that the Summit County Health Department is doing is they are launching their active transportation. They're going to be putting some things on their website, and they're working with Summit County staff, the Planning and Engineering and Public Works Department, to we're working together to promote active transportation and provide those safe pathways that allow people to move around and get exercise and still get to where they need to go.
Let's hear from Diane Foster, our city manager. Diane, your question or comment?
Thanks. I'd just like to hear the hear the panel talk about bus rapid transit versus light rail between Kimball Junction and Park City.
Okay, gang. Did you get that? Do you need me to repeat that question? Bus rapid transit versus light rail.
But for people who might not know or you hadn't heard the term before, bus rapid transit is really just a way to rapidly to provide for the rapid movement of a rubber-tired vehicle in the same manner that light rail moves. How do you do that? There's a full spectrum of ways you can do that. It could be a dedicated lane. It could be mixed-use lane. It could drive in regular traffic. Of course, when you drive in regular traffic, it's not as rapid. For years, the transit district or our transit system has been moving in that direction with the idea of having these dedicated bus lanes along 224 and 248 where we could get those queue jumpers, which allows the bus to jump the queue at a signal so that they can save a few seconds. Technology that allows that communicates with the signal that lets it know there's a bus in the signal queue and gives it a little extra time so the bus can clear in that bus queue. So those are some of the ways that a lot of communities struggle. One of the ways that really slows down a bus is paying the fare, and we kind of figured that out already. So we don't need all sorts of technology for that. So low floor buses, same thing, so you can just walk right in. Generally, level boarding when you get more sophisticated each year stop, so it's convenient and easy. It's a lower density land use solution for transit than light rail. The beauty of it is it can be used as a pathway to higher capacity systems in the future. If you lock down the right-of-way for a bus rapid transit system, say now, you know, that could provide the right-of-way in the future for some other mode traveling along it. So that's bus rapid transit. Okay. So much more cost-effective until you reach a certain mass of ridership, and then light rail makes more sense. So,
okay. Additional comments?
Yeah, I'd like to make one just because the Mountain Accord has gotten such a reputation for being all about trains, and those are the sexy object that have come up in the conversations, but that isn't what it's about. It's about a spectrum of options, and that is at the very top of the options. And the Wasatch Front back in the 70s saw their growth coming and said, we need to start working today on a future rail system. And it wasn't until the late 90s that that started to get implemented, and it just today is starting to come together. And now they're looking at that and they're seeing where future growth is, and they're saying, someday we're going to need rail on the Wasatch back, and we're going to need better east-west connections. And those are the conversations that are starting today for the system that we're likely to see 20, 30, maybe 50 years from now. Bus rapid transit and some of these express options are very good options that we can implement today. And as Kent pointed out, those will secure those right-of-ways, those will train our users, and those will give us some idea of volume and traffic. So I think there are proposals on the table today from the Mountain Accord to do that on 224, 248, and potentially I-80. And I think one of the advantages of us participating in the Mountain Accord is they bring the expertise and potential federal funding to make that a reality.
Kim, did you have a comment?
Yes. You know, there could be a great progression if we can get that reserved right-of-way for the use for the buses, and then we could progress to rail. Or most likely, it will end up being some other technology. We had the opportunity to meet with an official in Zermatt, and they're looking at a monorail system that's based on roller coaster technology that has individual pods, which can make stops without stopping the whole progression of the rest of the riders, and it was really exciting, so we look forward to getting more information on that. And that's real technology. So,
okay, I can see that headline
today
in the Park Record, roller coaster coming on 224.
Whoa, wait.
Oh, wait a minute, a little clarification for Jay out there. Okay, anybody else want to touch on the light rail versus rapid bus? What sort of population typically do you see before a light rail system goes into place? Sean?
Yeah, I could probably speak to that. Provo Orem is building a bus rapid transit system right now. We were just listed in the president's budget this year. It's a $150 million project. Provo and Orem have a combined population of about 200,000 population to get really good ridership on that BRT at about 13,000 riders per day is what that will do. It'll be one of the best performing BRT systems in the nation. It'll be fantastic. So we looked at that and said, would we consider building light rail on that alignment? And it probably could justify it with the ridership, but the expense is so much greater, probably $60 million a mile to build light rail when Wow. you compare it to about $10 million a mile for dedicated lane BRT. So dramatic price increase. It depends on what your budget will allow you to do.
Okay, thank you. Glenn Wright, your question.
Yes, I looked at the county's transportation plan today from last December, and I see a fiscally constrained plan, and I'm not sure what you call it, but the big dollar plan. When I look through the fiscally constrained plan, to me it looks like a failed transportation plan for the county. Looks like we're going to have jammed roads, and I don't see it coming up with the kind of capacity we need. That $345 million seems like a very scary number to people, but I think when we look at the population increases, the economic increases with increased visitors to the county, that should be a manageable number over 20 or 25 years. I think the key is, how do we sell it? I see this required transit service levels, 130,000 passengers per day, 3,330 vehicle hours of service per day. When you do that math, it comes out that each one of those vehicle hours of service is carrying 40 passengers. That's a pretty robust system. And what our friend from Wasatch County just said, 13,000 people on BRT, we're looking at 130,000. That we're going to be requiring down the road. My question is, what, you know, to sell this to the population, I think I'm easy. I see that this is something we need to do. But a lot of the taxpayers in the community are probably not as easy as I am in that respect. What's the vision that we can sell to the population? What are we buying? If I say, okay, I'll buy a tax increase now to make my community better down the road, what am I buying? What's the vision?
Okay. And, you know, you can even I didn't ask the question because I didn't want to scare anybody, but I did look at that same transportation plan, and I think, Glenn, that's a great question, because it's like, let's talk about failure. We don't want to talk about that, but currently the LOS level of service on 224, it consists of 7 segments. Leslie and Kim, I'm sure you know this. There's 2 Bs, 1 C, and 4 Ds right now. If nothing is done with 224 at entitled and projected conditions, and we may not see that for a long time, but your study says all 7 segments will fall to LOS level of service F. Just like academic grades, that's as bad as you can get, okay? So, Glenn's question, you know, let's take that up. What do we say to the population? Do we scare them, or, you know, some of the things we've talked about earlier? Screw up the question there?
You know, I don't think it's scaring them, but I do think we need to approach it cautiously before we go and invest in rail. I think we need to look at some of the other things that we've talked about tonight and implement those and get some change in behavior of the residents in the community. And, you know, one thing with rail is that when you make that investment's there for the long term. You know, there's trains in Europe that have been around for 150 years, and, you know, they're still going strong with a bit of maintenance here and there. So it is a long-term investment, and people need to take that into consideration.
Well, I think that's behaviors change. Behaviors have to change sometimes. Of course, you know, and there's plenty of cities in the United States where public transportation is what most of the people do. Out here in the wild open West, we've been riding horses or driving cars for 100-plus years. One person per horse, one person per car. You know, that's kind of our history here. So it's a behavioral shift, but I'm sure it's doable if necessary.
I was excited to learn that they're going to be putting some hitching posts in the bottom of my neighborhood.
Yeah. We'll do all forms of transportation. That's right. In Silver Creek, horses still rule.
Okay. So just one more thing. Just speaking as an engineer, those level of service grades for what they are only for a few hours a day. And those are not, that's not the continuum. That's not there was some talk during the preparation of that plan of whether level of service is a good indicator for failure of a road. That was never really resolved. But a level of service F, maybe for 2 hours a day, happens at 224. And the rest of the time, it functions fine. So what does that tell me? That just tells me that, well, we can make the road bigger for 2 hours a day, or we can change our behavior. We can have flex hours. We can get people to shop earlier. We can get, like my colleague Patrick Putt says, get the liquor stores to open earlier so that we don't have that traffic. So it's...
It has nothing to do with transportation. He just wants the liquor stores.
But I think...
Pat's in our audience here.
I think that looking at the whole picture, looking at it comprehensively and understanding what's driving that, those are all numbers, and I love numbers and I love facts, but when I step back away and I look at the behaviors and try to understand why it's an F, I think that's something we can manage, and that's the low-hanging fruit. That's what we want to grab before we spend $345 million. We want to grab that low-hanging fruit and see what we can avoid spending in the future.
Okay. Glenn, did we answer your question, or did I sort of muddle it up for you? Okay. 20 years, Sean, then Andy?
You know, I love this question. This is something that the Utah Transportation Coalition recently dealt with over the past 2 years, which was the driving force behind House Bill 362. That's the bill that council member talked to about the 5-cent gas tax increase, and then the fourth quarter, we call it. And implementing those two funding mechanisms will provide Utah a strong economy, I think, is the argument and the vision behind that effort. Utah is the only state in the United States that has a unified transportation plan. What that means is all the MPOs, the Metropolitan Planning Organizations, along with the state Transportation Department and the Utah Transit Authority combine all of our plans together and say, can we afford to build ourselves at an acceptable level of service? The answer is yes. We will have particular problems on particular routes, but we can overcome that as we're discussing tonight. But I think the overall vision of the state of Utah is one that transportation is the lifeblood of our economy and it facilitates a strong economy. The vision is crystal clear, I think, at the state of Utah level. So we're doing good there.
Interesting point because, yes, Utah, we do transportation very well compared to a lot of states, especially back east with really infrastructure that is really crumbling. And we spend money in Utah on transportation, and we have a good system, at least in terms of well-respected by the other states of the union, of the nation. Andy?
Well, I find the numbers pretty daunting. I mean, it's amounts that we don't have to solve this. But that being said, Glenn, I think we have to come up with a solution. We live here because of that high quality of life. Our guests come here for the Mountain Town experience, and congestion and traffic just aren't part of that. We have a threshold at which that will break, and we won't want to live here, and people won't kind of want to come here. So we have to come up with solutions. And I think it's going to be a combination of these smaller creative solutions that are going to be short-term fixes, and we are going to have to continue to work regionally with both the state and the feds to come up with some of these larger solutions, the ones that will endure, like rail, that may last 100 years, and they are going to have to be financed, and they're going to have big price tags.
I think we have the vision of where we want to be 20 to 25, 30, 40, 50 years down the road. You know, we can all picture the idyllic scene with these wonderful trails. You have people out of their cars. They're out there using it. That's our vision, but we're still developing how we're going to get there.
Other comments? If not, Mr. Mike Andrews, your question.
Thank you. So good tonight to be here and to hear such a good discussion. And I have a lot of hope for the future because I know so many of the people who are involved in this process, and I have confidence that they will approach it intelligently. But as somebody who is 16 short months away from octogenarian status, I'm not going to worry about 25 years from now, frankly. I'm more concerned about getting from Jeremy Ranch into Park City. And I've heard some good suggestions tonight. And I have another one. While I have a smartphone for my generation doesn't all have smartphones. And we need to remember that communication and informing the population of what you are planning and how it will get done is important. And it's not going to just happen on a smartphone. It has to happen on the radio. It has to happen on the TV. It has to happen in print, you know, that thing we call paper. So, Leslie, I love your future-looking vision, but please don't forget the more basic way to communicate with people. That's very, very important. Secondly, the problem is now. Right now is the problem. And yes, we've got to try to convince people that they can stay off the roads at certain times. And I personally would love to use a bus to go into Ski, but I can't get to a bus on a convenient schedule. Kim, I hope your transit center is going to work out. I frankly don't think it is. I think it's a failure in the works. Unless we have adequate parking where I can come from my little neighborhood, drive 3-4 minutes to a center, park my car, take my skis or my shopping bag, and get on a bus that's going to take me into Park City. I love the suggestion of the gentleman earlier. Put the parking lots along 224 where the buses will stop and pick you up. And I loved your idea that we were not going to add two more lanes to 224. What are we going to do, take 6 lanes and dump them into two? So look immediately to the solutions that we need for the problems now. And yes, look down the road for 25 years. And I think we all have that vision, but my time is up.
He is our timekeeper.
And as a good timer, I'm going to sit down.
That was very fair of you, Mike. Any comments on Mike's comments? And then we'll try to get one final question in for this nice lady.
I really appreciate your reminder. And we have been working to try to get information out in a variety of ways, but I'll talk to Julie Booth about that specifically and make sure that we have a lot of different distribution points, including to our senior centers and things like that. That's an excellent point. And, you know, I think our staff has been working so dang hard, and I know Park City's has been too. I mean, it's amazing when you look at the list of things that they have been working on over the past 2 years. I was going back through past agendas, and we've had transportation on our agendas 20 times in the 27 months that I've been a council member, 5 times in the last 3 months. And they haven't just been quick conversations. They've been deep conversations about what changes can we make and which ones are more long-term. What can we do right now to make a difference? So one of those, and Roger Armstrong left, but one thing he's been promoting, so I'm going to put it out there for him, is
he's probably listening on KPCW.
He probably is.
Sure.
So Roger, this one's for you, but he really wants to promote a campaign for people to get out of their cars and ride mass transit at least once a week. If everybody made that choice just one time a week, it would make a huge difference.
So I appreciate your comments, and I'm going to turn that around a little bit. So just from my perspective, been at this a long time, and what I do know is you have both councils who are firmly focused on this issue, and are working as furiously and driving their staff as furiously as they can. And that's not a complaint. Actually,
driving some of them right into retirement.
I lost my point. No, I didn't. That's part of getting old, I guess. But my greatest fear is this, is that as a community, we will not have the patience that allow the policymakers and staff to properly plan for problems today and in the future, and we're driven into making bad decisions that lead to more bad decisions, and we waste our energy chasing our tail to get things done. We don't need a lot of time, but we need some space, you know, to get that done in. And I just feel this growing pressure on my elected officials to do something, and we're working as fast and as furiously as we can. These are big, expensive, long enduring projects that need to be done right, and if I assure you, with the focus that's on it, if we're given that space, we'll accomplish it. So that's my little spiel.
Yeah, I'd just like to quickly echo what both Kim and Kent said. I know with the Park City Council, Diane Foster, our city manager, recently said, you guys just have too many things you're pressing on at the same time. You need to pick a few to prioritize. And transportation and affordable housing are our top two issues, and it's something we're working quite hard on. And I often hear from folks that you shouldn't be spending so much time working on the future. You should be working on the present. And we're working on both at this point. We are pressing hard on both fronts because we believe both are critical, and that's why we've made it such a priority, and we're putting a lot of resources into it now. So we're trying to address the here and now, but we also feel a need to look forward and put things in place that are going to be needed 20, 30, 40 years from now.
Okay, thank you, Andy. We have about 3 minutes left, so hopefully we have a short question or comment and some short answers. Ma'am, name and question.
My name's Andrea. I haven't thought this out very much. It just occurred to me now. But with the Uber thought and the smartphone thoughts put together, and not having to build transportation sites so that we go from our car to that little short little distance to the hub center to get into the bus, why don't we maybe consider more about Uber, or I don't even know how Uber works, but just being able to call from my house on my cell phone. I'm in Summit Park, and maybe there's some people who are doing that in Summit Park. I know there's not at this point, but in our close future, we assign people to say, all right, I need to get to Kimball Junction or to the Jeremy Ranch bus stop, so I can just call one of these Uber guys, and they'll come get me and bring me there. I've never gotten into my car at this point. Yes, this one person's driving around in their car, but maybe that's a better idea than building larger hub centers to, because what if we all start taking the bus? The hub centers will never be big enough. So maybe we should just consider the present that we have now, which is pretty darn good, and the use of our smartphones. So when we get off that bus, when we're done, we're still on the bus, and we can call the Uber guy and say, pick us up. It's snowing, it's raining, whatever, right when you get off the bus. And I don't know, that's just a thought.
Okay.
You have some awesome suggestions, and that's great. Let me tell you about this rideamigos.com, what it will do. You can actually go in, and you can set up your own carpool. You can say, I'm traveling from Jeremy Ranch to Salt Lake City Monday through Friday. I leave my house at 7 in the morning. I leave Salt Lake at 4 in the afternoon. And you can have people in your neighborhood get on, and you can carpool. You can create your own carpools. You can create your own van pools. And there's also a tool on there for a school pool. We can get into the school districts, and the school districts will send out an email to all of the parents, and the parents can work together to ferry their children from their homes or their neighborhoods to the school. And we can eliminate 3 or 4 trips by allowing 3 or 4 children in the same vehicle. And so there are those applications out there, and we are intent and excited to implement those in Summit County.
Whenever we have these forums, I'm just so impressed by all of our public officials, elected and staff. We are so well served. I hope the audience tonight, the audience here at St. Luke's, and listening to us on KPCW, understands the depth of knowledge of this group and how serious they all are about the issues. And in terms of our elected officials, you know, the compensation is not great. They're doing it for all of the quote-unquote right reasons, and we certainly want to thank them. I also want to thank Father Charles Robinson for spearheading these programs. I, for one, think they're very, very valuable. I want to thank the Project for Deeper Understanding Committee for doing the heavy lifting. And, of course, we want to thank our panelists tonight, our audience here at St. Luke's, and our KPCW radio audience. Let's give each other a hand. Okay, it is...